you have your Bible, and I hope you do, we are in the book of Esther this morning. So if you open your Bible to about the middle, and you go back a little bit, so before Psalms, before Job, right there is the book of Esther. It's an amazing book that we're going to be spending time in between now and probably Thanksgiving, as we look at what is one of the latest written books in the Old Testament. It's a story that, as we get into it, you'll see. A couple of years ago, there were a couple of books that I got sent to me that I thought were pretty interesting. They were exploring the plight of the Jews living in exile in Babylon in the 6th century. And these books were examining what it was like to live as faithful religious people in a culture that does not support your religious background. Because that was the case for the Jews. You remember when we studied Psalm 137 a couple of weeks ago, by the waters of Babylon we laid down our harps because we were remembering Zion, we were remembering the Lord, but they were away from the temple, they were away from worship, they couldn't sing the Psalms. So in Babylon, during that time when the Jews were in Babylon, they were separated from their practice of religion. And these books that I got sent to me were saying, let's look at their experience and see what we can learn from it. Because it's a pretty relevant question for us right now. As Christians in America, what does it look like to live faithfully and rightly before God when you're living in a culture that has rejected biblical morality and biblical ethics and that doesn't really value your religion and wants you to keep it to yourself? That's what the Jews were experiencing, and we're experiencing some of that in our culture today. So these books that came were two of them. One was called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture, by a guy named Larry Osborne. And the other book was a book called Onward, Engaging in Culture Without Losing the Gospel, by Russell Moore. Both of these books looked carefully at the life of Daniel, because the stories of Daniel's life are stories that come from that time in the Babylonian exile. Daniel was a faithful, heroic, courageous man of God who stood firmly for God in a pagan culture. I want to make sure you get the timeline for all of this in your mind. The reason I keep coming back to this is because I think I've told you, I was probably a Christian for 15 or 20 years before I understood the Old Testament chronology and where things go. So I'm just going to keep repeating this for you to help you get it in your mind. So you remember we looked here at the timeline a few weeks ago, and a couple of dates you should know. 722 BC, that's when the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes of Israel in the north, that's when they fell to the Assyrians. That was the end of the northern kingdom. The Assyrians came from the north, attacked them, wiped them out. That's it. Now all that's left are the two tribes in the south meeting in Jerusalem, living around Jerusalem. But they fell in 586 BC. That's another date you ought to know. That's when the Babylonians came and attacked Jerusalem. Now let me just share with you that attack on Jerusalem didn't happen in a week. That happened over years. So when we say 586, that's when the final fall of Jerusalem was. But the Babylonian forces had been coming against Jerusalem over and over again, repeatedly, over a period of years. So 586 was the final fall, the southern kingdom in Babylon. And then in 539, Darius, the king of the Medes and the Persians, conquered Babylon and released the Jews. So from 586 to 539, the Jews were living in exile in Babylon. And they were slaves, whole new generation, born, raised in Babylon. And now in 539, it's an interesting story because the king of the Babylonians was having a party, and it was a weekend party, and he was drunk, and Darius came in and in the course of a weekend took over. I mean, wiped him out in a three-day period, and Babylon fell, and what had been the Babylonian Empire now became the Persian Empire, as the Medes and the Persians came in, and Darius was the king of the Medes and the Persians. Which brings you to your final date on here, which is 525 BC. That's when the Jews are rebuilding Jerusalem. When Darius released the Jews back in 539, some of the Jews in Babylon decided, we're going to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. And over a period of years, there were three waves of exiles, of refugees, who went back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city. And they went back and they rebuilt their homes, and then they started rebuilding the wall. You've read Ezra, Nehemiah, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah are all about this rebuilding time in Israel. So they built their homes, they built the wall, and then they just kind of took a couple of years off, and finally they said, we have homes that have paneled walls and God doesn't have a house. And so they began rebuilding the temple. Now, there were about 50,000 Jews who went back to Jerusalem after they were freed from Babylon. There were a whole bunch more Jews who just stayed put. I mean, these were people who, as I said, had been born and raised in Babylon. The culture of Babylon was all they knew. And when Darius said, you're free, you can go back and rebuild your homeland, there were a lot of them who were like, yeah, you know, we're pretty comfortable here. That's a long trip. We're kind of settled. I'm not sure we want to go do that. The 50,000 who went back had a zeal to see the Jewish religion and the worship of God exalted again, raised up again, thriving again. The ones who stayed, they were kind of happy with the culture the way it is. I read something. I'm going to see if I can find this. This was not in my notes for this morning, so bear with me. But I read something this week in the Wall Street Journal about Jews in America. And I think I've got it here. Again, pardon me for not being fully prepared on this. But this was interesting, yeah. This is an American, an Orthodox Jew in America, who says, get over there. Over the past several decades, the American Jewish community has experienced profound demographic changes. Reform and conservative Jews have fewer children. They attend synagogue less often. They increasingly intermarry with non-Jews. They're less supportive of Israel and are generally becoming less distinguishable from non-Jewish progressives. That's what the Jews in Babylon were experiencing during the time after the exile. These were people who were kind of secularized Jews living in Babylon. Okay, let me get back to my notes here. So this brings us to the story of Esther, and this is why I'm giving you all of this history, because Esther happens in Persia after some Jews have gone back to rebuild Jerusalem, but Esther and her cousin Mordecai are remaining in Persia along with tens of thousands of Jews who have settled there and kind of assimilated with the Babylonian culture. This book tells us the story of a couple of key Jews who we'll meet this morning who were now practicing, were no longer practicing their Judaism, but were living under the reign of King Darius's son, King Ahasuerus, in Persia. And Mike Cosper, who is the author of a book called Faith Among the Faithless, that's a great book on Esther. It's all about learning to live in a world gone mad, how we can learn from Esther that. He says, in addition to looking at the life of Daniel for clues on how to live courageously and heroically in a pagan culture, we need to be looking at the life of Esther. Daniel's not the only model. In fact, he says there's a problem with looking at Daniel. Most of us aren't Daniel. In fact, we're far from it. As much as we recognize that our culture is in decline, we also kind of like it. Christians in general consume as much mass media and are as addicted to pornography, as likely to divorce, as consumeristic, and as obsessed with social media as the rest of the world. See, it's easy for all of us to become enculturated where we live. He says, Daniel's faith was ironclad. He never let the pressure of exile shake his faith and didn't adopt the dominant culture's way of life. But he says we should look at an alternative to the Daniel model, someone who was born into exile, disconnected from a heritage of faith, out of touch with the practices that marked her people as distinct from the surrounding world, one who nonetheless found a way back to her identity as one of God's people, and who might illustrate a path forward for the rest of us. I'm talking about Esther, but not the Esther you may think you know. I'm talking about the real Esther, the biblical and historical Esther, whose life was a whirlwind of spiritual compromise and spiritual awakening, and whose story is full of power, sex, and violence. But this would be a Netflix limited series, easily. Esther's story reveals a way forward in a culture where people of faith find themselves at the margins of society. She neither clutches for power nor seeks self-protection. Instead, she faces reality, embraces weakness, and finds faith, hope, and help from a world unseen. Her story is also an invitation to those whose faith, convictions, and morality are less than they wish they were. Good book for us to study, because it mirrors where a lot of us are living. And for those of you who want to go deeper in your study of Esther, I'd recommend you get a copy of Mike Cosper's book. It's easy to read and very helpful. Today, we're going to get an overview for this study. We'll get the background of the book of Esther, and then next week we'll dive into the story. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce the subject by looking at the first 9 verses in Esther chapter 1. So if you've got it open, we'll read it together. But before we read, let me pray for our time in God's Word. Father, this is your Word that we're turning our attention to now. And we pray that you would speak to us through your Word by your Spirit. Our ears are tuned to you. Open our hearts and minds, take the blinders off, let us see and hear and know that you are speaking to us. And Lord, I pray that your Spirit would apply your Word specifically where it's needed in each of our lives this morning. And I pray it in your name. Amen. This is Esther chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. This is God's Word for God's people. You follow as I read. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the 3rd year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him. While he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods, and marble pillars, also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry and marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict: there is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. Amen. May God add his blessing to this reading of his word. So 4 things we'll look at from that text, and in our intro, we're going to look at the setting for this story. We're going to look at a brief biography of the main characters in this story, a little background on the book itself, and then a few of the key themes that are going to emerge from the book of Esther as we read through it. So let's look at the setting. The story of Esther takes place over a 10-year period, from roughly 483 to 473 BC. So 10 years. This is not happening in a few weeks. This is a 10-year period. This is about 50 years after King Darius has said, you can all go back to Jerusalem. Then the Babylonian Empire is overturned. So it's been the Medo-Persian Empire now for 50 years. There's a new king. His name is Ahasuerus. This takes place in Susa, which is the winter capital and residence for the king of Persia. And verse 1 tells us the scope of this Persian empire, which went from India to Ethiopia and covered 127 provinces. Let me show you the map, okay? So here is the ancient world. India on the far right, to Egypt, Ethiopia, and Africa over here on the left. This is the area you see Susa right here in the middle. There's the winter capital. The summer capital is down here in Persepolis. And Israel is here along Phoenicia, Syria. That's where Jerusalem is and where that's all set. And then Asia Minor up there. And it goes all the way up to the border of Greece up here in Europe, down into Egypt and Africa. It's a pretty big chunk of land, okay? 2.2 million square miles, about the size of the United States, is the country. And population estimated 49 million people. It was 44% of the world's population at that time that was under the reign of King Ahasuerus. He's a big deal. He's the biggest deal in the world in his day. There's nobody who has a higher profile. This is the world power, and he runs it. And this is go to the next map, because this will show it. This is where it is in modern day. So same area, but you see it includes Pakistan and Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Egypt, and Turkey. So big chunk of the Middle East is where the Persian Empire took place back then. It includes Jerusalem. Israel is right there. The Jews are living at peace, the 50,000 who went back and who are rebuilding the city and are rebuilding their families. So it's now more than 50,000 as they've repopulated the land. But they're living as part of the Persian Empire, which means they can kind of do what they want as long as they don't stir up trouble, raise up a big army, and as long as they pay their taxes. Darius is fine with you just living however you want to live as long as you don't create trouble, put together a threatening army, and as long as you pay your taxes. And the king, Ahasuerus in this case, wanted to grow his empire. He looked at these 2.2 million square miles, and he said it's not big enough. In fact, during the time that the story of Esther takes place, the king mounted a military campaign against Greece and tried to take Greece as new territory. He was repelled by the Greek city-states that all came together and formed their armies, kept the Persian armies from victory, but he amassed a big army to go through all of this. In fact, this party that we're reading about at the beginning, this 180-day party, well, part of the reason for that party was to party, which, by the way, they weren't Christians, so they were partying. It wasn't a fellowship time for them. It was a party, okay? But part of the reason for this party was so that they could have a party, but part of the reason for this was you were expected to bring gifts to the party. You were expected to pay tribute to the king. He was putting together a financial war chest and amassing the generals and the armies together for this campaign against Greece. This was a rally time for the coming war against Greece. So that's the setting for the book. The Persian Empire is huge. There are some faithful Jews back in Jerusalem, but most of the Jews, like Esther and like Mordecai, are living outside the Promised Land as members of the Persian Empire, and everybody is living under the rule and reign of the rich king Ahasuerus, who's the most powerful man in the world at the time. So let's talk about him, about Ahasuerus, as we get into the four main characters in this story. And I'm going to spend most of our time this morning talking about him. I'll introduce the other three to you, but we'll get to know the other three better as we go through the book. Ahasuerus is also known, what's his other name? Anybody know? Xerxes, not Artaxerxes, that's his son. So this is King Xerxes the First. That's his Greek name, Xerxes the First. He is mentioned 190 times in the 167 verses in the book of Esther. So he's pretty central to the story. His name, or the king, 190 times. His name in Hebrew is Ahasuerus, and there's a little tongue-in-cheek here because Ahasuerus sounds a little bit like the Hebrew word for a headache. So the Jews loved calling him King Headache. I mean, that was how they viewed him. Of course, we don't know exactly what Ahasuerus looked like, but there is a tomb in Iran, which is located in the city of Persepolis, modern-day Iran, and there's this carving, at the tomb of Xerxes, where that's outside of his tomb. So we got that, and then some artist gave us this one as a little close-up, looks something like that. I don't know if he had the beaded beard or not, but and then an artist took it a little further and said maybe he looks something like, is there one more in the middle? There's not one more? I messed up on that. Okay. So we combine the biblical record with the historical record, and we get a picture of who this man is. There was a Greek historian. When the Greeks eventually took over the Persian Empire, which happened, the Persian Empire had about a 200-year run, and then the Greeks came and took over in about 350 BC. When they did, one of the things that they did was they installed an historian, a Greek historian named Herodotus, who came in, and he was to write the history of the Persian Empire. And best we can tell, he was a pretty objective historian, and he gives us a lot of data about King Xerxes. Herodotus says he was tall, he was handsome, he was ambitious, he was ruthless, and he was a skilled warrior. Herodotus also describes him as controlling, impatient, hot-tempered, and he was known for terrible fits of rage and for excessive cruelty. Powerful, wealthy, temperamental, cruel, self-indulgent, and a hedonist with no restraint to his personal appetites. That's the king. In fact, in the text we looked at this morning, this six-month party, look back at verse 4. He showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. He wanted to make sure everybody over a six-month period understood how great he was, how rich he was, and how powerful he was. They were invited to the party to bring their tribute and their gifts, and he was raising money for this coming war. He showed off his wealth. The first 6 months, he was inviting the big shots. So it was the generals and it was the rulers from around the empire. And all of them were expected to come and all of them were expected to bring money. And then at the end of the 6 months, he had a seven-day kind of a party for everybody who lived in Susa. This was the common people and they were welcome. You could come and you could get your tour of the palace. You didn't get to tour the palace if you lived in Susa unless the king invited you in. Well, here he opened the courtyard, the garden. Everybody could come in and everybody partied because he wanted everybody at the end of those 7 days to go, isn't he the greatest? We love King Xerxes. Mm-hmm. Verse 6 says, describes the wealth of this. Did you get this as we read through this? There were white cotton curtains. How big do you think this palace was? It was huge. There were white cotton curtains on every window in the palace. Now, I've just been over in Europe, and I've seen some of these palaces, and I've seen some of these windows, and I didn't see a lot of curtains, because curtains weren't what most people did. But this king said, I want curtains on all of my windows, white cotton curtains, and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple. Reason for that is because violet is the royal color. Purple is the royal color. Purple was the most expensive kind of color. If you wore purple, you were rich, because only rich people could get purple. This king decided to have purple hangings all over the palace. Not only purple hangings, cords of fine linen, but he hung them on silver curtain rods. I don't know what kind of curtain rods you have at your house, but ours are not silver. We do not use precious metals for our curtain rods. But this guy used precious metal, silver, for his curtain rods. Then he had marble pillars in the castle, couches of gold and silver. Couches. I want a new couch. Let's make one of gold, right? I mean, this is a guy who just, there is nothing, the word excess is not in his vocabulary. And the pavement, mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. He doesn't just want a concrete slab. He doesn't just want cobblestone. He wants the floors to be made of beautiful material. Now, let me just say, there's a day coming when we're going to walk on streets of gold. So if that's how the king wants to do it, that's his own business. But he made sure that this palace sparkled from head to toe. I'm not sure who the interior decorator for this project was, but they clearly didn't have a budget they had to deal with. Whatever he wanted, they did it. Now remember, This is a royal palace 2,500 years ago. You go back and look at the ruins of the homes that people lived in 2,500 years ago, and it's like they lived in closets. Bedrooms were scarce. The king here is living in opulence while most people are trying to get a roof over their head. It's clear he prioritized his own luxury and his own comfort ahead of everything else. This is who he is. He's extravagant and he's over the top. He is a man of conspicuous consumption. You've heard that phrase, right? Conspicuous consumption. Conspicuous consumption, this is from Wikipedia, is the spending of money and the acquiring of luxury goods and services to publicly display economic power of the income of or of the accumulated wealth of the buyer. You're showing off how rich and powerful you are. To the conspicuous consumer, such a public display of discretionary economic power is a means of either attaining or maintaining a given social status. You're a conspicuous consumer, so everybody knows just how big a deal you are. And Xerxes put the big in big deal, okay? He's probably not only a conspicuous consumer, but he was a partier. He was a hedonist. His pleasure was also a high priority. So look back at verse 7. Drinks were served in golden vessels. I mean, let's get out the gold to serve our drinks in. Vessels of different kinds. The royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And the edict was no rules. So the edict of this party was drink as much as you like. This is Mardi Gras for 6 months. That's what's going on with this party. So again, this gives you an insight into the king, King Headache, King Xerxes. And it is also from the historical record, not from the biblical record, but from the historical record, that we get insight into the cruelty and the savagery of King Xerxes. I'll go back and forth between Ahasuerus and Xerxes, but probably Xerxes is shorter and easier to say than Ahasuerus over and over again. Herodotus, the historian, says Xerxes at one point tried to seduce his brother's wife, and when she refused, he ended up taking his daughter, his brother's daughter, for himself, and then after that he arranged for the whole family to be murdered. He's the king. He can do whatever he wants. And if you say no, there are consequences to pay. There was a man who gave Xerxes what would have amounted to millions of dollars in today's economy to help fund the war against Greece. This guy had five sons who were all conscripted into the army of Xerxes. And he asked Xerxes, would it be possible for one of my sons to come back and stay with me and take care of me while the other four are at war? And Xerxes had the son put to death, sawn in two, and sent both parts back to the dad and said, here you go. That's how self-focused and cruel Xerxes was. Rich and powerful and cruel. You don't ask him for a favor. We'll see in this story, some of you know, that Esther was afraid to go see the king uninvited. You go see the king without an invitation, you can be put to death. He is a man who can respond with violence to any whim. So that's Xerxes. Xerxes, second main character, is his chief of staff. His chief of staff is the guy named Haman. Now, we don't have any pictures of Haman, but I'm going to show you the picture that I always think about when I think about Haman. Okay, who under the age of 15 knows who that is? Do you know who that is if you're under the age of 15? Anybody? Oh, you parents, you're failing to bring your children up on the classics. Parents, who is that? That's Jafar from Aladdin. You remember Jafar? Because the king in Aladdin was kind of this doofus little, you know, feeble-minded, and Jafar was always there whispering in his ear, oh, king, flattering him and saying all kinds of things and getting, basically manipulating the king for his own purposes. That's Haman. Yeah. Haman is the chief of staff, but he's always flattering Xerxes, kind of keeping his options open, but he's whispering into the king's ear, don't you think this is a good idea, king? Oh, your greatness will shine so far if you'll just do these things. Richard Loesch says Haman is the paragon of arrogance in the Old Testament. In rabbinic tradition, Haman was considered the archetype of evil. Arrogant and evil and manipulative and self-serving. Now, this is interesting. Esther chapter 3 tells us that Haman was an Agagite. That means he was a descendant of King Agag. Now, you may not remember King Agag, but back in 1 Samuel 15, we have this story of King Saul. I'm taking you back. King Saul lived around 1100 BC. We're now in 450 BC, so I'm going back 600 years. 600 years earlier, when King Saul, the first king of Israel, had been raised up, 1 Samuel chapter 15, God comes to King Saul and he says, I want you to wage war against the Amalekites and I want you to wipe them out. Now, why did God do that? Well, you have to go back 500 years before that, because when the Jews were coming out of Egypt in the Exodus, as they came out from Egypt, the Amalekites were waiting there, and they tried to attack the Jews and capture them and take their stuff. They were basically raiders and marauders who tried to capture or tried to do injury to the Jews. So God, 500 years later, now that Israel has a king, says, we're going to finish the business with the Amalekites who attacked you 500 years ago. So he sends the king, Saul and his armies, to wage war against the Amalekites, and it's a victorious war. But you may remember that God told Saul, when you capture the Amalekites, I want you to wipe them out utterly. Leave no human being alive and kill all the livestock. And Saul got down there and he said, you know, that seems harsh. So he kept the livestock and he kept King Agag alive and brought them back as slaves. Well, Samuel, the prophet, comes and hears about this and goes, what? Why did you not obey God? In fact, this is where we get that famous verse, to obey is better than sacrifice. You got to obey God when he tells you to do something. So Samuel takes it on himself to kill King Agag. But here's what apparently happened. Some of the descendants of Agag survived the battle and got away without being killed. Now jump ahead 600 years later, and Haman is a descendant of this Amalekite king, Agag. He's an Agagite. I haven't mentioned this yet, but the story of Esther is at the heart of the Jewish feast that is celebrated every year in the spring, the Feast of what? Purim. And the Jews will get together for a couple of days and they will read the story of Esther as they celebrate Purim. And as part of the feast, they read the story of Esther aloud and they give the children what's called a gragger. And a gragger looks like this. It's a noisemaker, okay, where you spin it around and it makes clicking noises. So kids all get one of these during Purim, and when the story of Esther is read, every time Haman's name comes up, the kids are supposed to use their gragger and make noise and go, boo! It's just part of the fun of reading the story. Every time you say Haman, you make the noisemaker and you shout, boo. So those are the two bad guys in the story of Esther. Xerxes and his chief of staff, the arrogant and evil Haman. The other two characters are the good guys, Esther and Mordecai. And like I said, we're not going to talk much about them because we're going to get to know them. There's not much information about Esther or Mordecai in the historical record, and not much information except in the book of Esther. Esther's name is not mentioned outside of the book. Neither is Mordecai's name mentioned outside of the book. So all we know is what's in the book. So we'll learn about them as we go through this. But let me talk about Mordecai first. Esther 2:5 says a little bit about his lineage. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish. He was a Benjamite. Now, you probably are going, I don't know Jair, Shimei, or Kish. And when it says he was the son of these three, they're not saying he was the son, like we're going back three generations. He's saying descendants of these famous people. It would be like somebody saying, I'm a son of Abraham Lincoln, or I'm a son of Thomas Jefferson. You could say that today without meaning he was my father, meaning I'm of that lineage, descendant of. Kish was the father of King Saul. back the Amalekite story, right? He's Saul's father. So Mordecai is in that line. And Shimei was one of Kish's relatives who fiercely supported King Saul during the time of Saul and David. In fact, in 2 Samuel 16:5, Shimei's name is mentioned. So Mordecai's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was one of the Jews who had you go back a couple generations, his great-great-grandfather was one of the Jews who had been deported from Jerusalem when the Babylonians took over. So you go back 100 years, and Mordecai's great-great-grandfather would have been back there. If his dad was deported, or his grandfather was deported and not killed, because remember when the Babylonians came in, they took over Jerusalem, they killed a lot of people, and they took back some as slaves. The ones they took back as slaves were either smart or healthy and muscular, or they had money. Everybody else kind of got wiped out. You just took the choice ones back as slaves. So Mordecai came from a line of nobility or strength or power in Jerusalem. And his family had been in the Babylonian Empire. Somehow they were in Susa now, and that's where they wound up. He was, some scholars, it's a little tricky. We don't know if he's a cousin or an uncle to Esther. So there's some relationship between him and Esther's dad. So either they were brothers and she's his niece, or Esther's dad and Mordecai's dad were brothers, and Esther and Mordecai are cousins. We don't know which, but he is. When Esther's parents are killed, Mordecai becomes the guardian for his, I'm going to call her a cousin, for his cousin Esther. He's older than her, but he's the guardian, the legal guardian. And Esther, we don't know a whole lot about her except what's in here. Her Hebrew name is not Esther. Anybody know? Hadassah is her Hebrew name. And it's actually her cousin Mordecai who gives her the name Esther, because there's a point in the story where he says it would be better for you to hide your Jewishness. And Hadassah is a pretty Jewish name, so we're going to call you Esther. And that's where she gets that name. She's not mentioned in the Bible outside of the book, so we won't learn a lot about her. But I like what Mike Cosper says about Esther. He says, do you read this story, and she emerges as a woman who, by the time the story unfolds, she embodies everything we think will make us happy. Esther is beautiful, she's rich, she's powerful, she has immense sexual charm and charisma, she has a legion of servants at her beck and call, she's kind of the Kim Kardashian of the Old Testament. Okay, so that gives you a picture of what we're talking about when we talk about Esther. Let's talk about the book that bears her name. We don't know who wrote the book. Some believe Mordecai wrote it. There's no indication of that in the book, and history doesn't give us a good example. The fact that it's written in the third person, if Mordecai wrote it, he wrote it as a detached observer and wrote about it historically. Most scholars think it was written within 100 years of these events happening. Again, if it was Mordecai, he did it pretty quickly. But you can tell that by some internal evidence that it's written at a time later than these events would have occurred, a time maybe much later. Because if you look at how the book opens, it says, now in the days of Ahasuerus, and then it says, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces in those days when he was on the royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of that reign. So this is somebody pointing back saying, you know, in the olden days, in those days, and they're describing that time period. So being very specific. Let me just say, by the way, that kind of detail lets you know we're not talking about a fable or a myth or a story. This is history. There are a lot of world religions that have a lot of mythology attached to them. The biblical writers wanted to make sure, you know, I'm telling you not just a fable. I'm telling you history. There was a real Esther. This really happened. Scholars think this was almost certainly written by a Jew who lived outside of Palestine, inside the Persian Empire, who was familiar with Susa, who was familiar with the Persian court, who knew the inner workings of this. So this is not somebody in Jerusalem writing this. This is somebody who is a Jew inside the Persian Empire. the thing that sets this book apart from the other books of the Bible, the other Old Testament books, or really all the books of the Bible, two things. One is, it's one of only two books that have a woman's name as a title. What's the other one? Ruth and Esther are the two women's name books. And this is one of two books that has no specific mention of God by name. God's name is not found in this book. Is there another one? Anybody know? Song of Songs. God is alluded to in the Song of Solomon, but he's not named. There's no Yahweh. There's no El Elyon. There, you see the king in Song of Solomon, and you can assume in some cases that God is being referenced there. In the book of Esther, God's completely absent. There's no praying. There's no sacrificing. There's no worship. There's no custom. These are fully secular Jews living a fully secular Persian life. Mike Cosper again says, God's hiddenness is what makes Esther such an important book for our day, too. A day when belief in God always feels resisted, contested, when everything seems to have a natural explanation, when our own experience often makes us feel as though God is indeed absent. One of the unique things about this book is God's giving us a book where his absence is by design. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Luther hated this book. Martin Luther did not like it. He said it Judaizes too much and it has a great deal of heathenish naughtiness. Indeed, it does have a great deal of heathenish naughtiness. One interesting note as we read through this, the Hebrew word that is translated feast or banquet in the book of Esther, which we see back in verse 3, he threw a feast. This word is used 20 times in the book of Esther. 10 chapters, feast, 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 over and over again. The rest of the Old Testament, it's only used 24 times. So Esther, there's a lot of feasting going on, and there are a lot of pivotal moments that are tied to these feasts. And by the way, it sets up an ongoing feast, which is the Feast of Purim that still goes on today. Purim, by the way, is the only Jewish feast that is still celebrated today that was not commanded to be celebrated in the Bible. God did not command Purim. The Jews have brought it up. Okay, finally, we'll get to a couple of the key themes in the book of Esther. One of the big themes is the providence of God. The idea of God's providence, some have suggested, and it's interesting to think about it this way, that the book of Esther is an extended Old Testament commentary on Romans 8:28. Romans 8:28, God is causing all things to work together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And Esther is the extended explanation. It's the proof that that's true. In Daniel, we see the miraculous supernatural work of God on behalf of his people, protecting and preserving them. In Esther, we see the unseen, hidden hand of God at work in the life of his children. And you read about the Exodus, and God shows up often big. In Esther, God is at work, but we don't see him. It's all happening behind the scenes. Let me give you a couple of definitions of this idea of providence that will help you as we go through this. The first comes from the Abstract of Principles for Southern and Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminaries. Okay, so it says this: God, this is providence, God from eternity decrees or permits all things that come to pass. Think about that for a second. Providence means that God from eternity decrees or permits all things that come to pass and perpetually upholds, directs, and governs all creatures and all events, yet so as not in any wise to be the author or disapprover of sin, or author or approver of sin, nor to destroy the free will and responsibility of intelligent creatures. God's in charge of everything. People still have free will. You go, well, how does that work? God will explain that to you later, okay? Because nobody gets it now. But that's providence. J.I. Packer puts it this way: the doctrine of providence teaches Christians that they are never in the grip of blind forces. There's no fortune, no chance, no luck, no fate. All that happens to them, to us, is divinely planned, and each event comes as a new summons to trust, obey, and rejoice, knowing that all is for one's spiritual and eternal good. That's the doctrine of providence. And Esther is all about God's providence being demonstrated in unseen ways in her life. In fact, the Bible, this makes perfect sense that God would give us a book in the Bible where the central theme of the book is that in the midst of our lives, there's always an unseen hand of providence, because your daily experience is not burning bushes and parting seas, right? Most of us do not see the demonstration of God's providence in the big ways that are pictured for us in the history of Israel or in the history of the New Testament. But every day, every moment, right here, in this moment, God's providence is at work in hidden, unseen ways. Esther is a book that shows you that, and this is really the second big idea, that what you may think of as coincidences are not coincidences. There's no such thing in God's economy as a coincidence. Well, technically, a coincidence means two things happening at the same time that may be disconnected but somehow overlap. That's a coincidence of things. Those things happen, but Esther is showing us that God is at work superintending all of the incidences and overlapping the ones that need to overlap in ways that we'll never see. In fact, here are some of the things. If you're familiar enough with the story of Esther, you know what's coming. So you know some of the things that had to happen in order for the Jews to be saved, that there was no way anybody could orchestrate other than God. So, for example, Vashti had to refuse to do what the king wanted her to do and get kicked out. That doesn't happen. None of the rest of this happens. And then, out of all of the women in Susa, Xerxes had to pick Esther to be the one he wanted, or the Jews don't survive. And Mordecai had to be in exactly the right place to overhear a couple of guards talking about this plot to kill the Jews. If he doesn't hear that, the Jews are exterminated. And then Esther had to have the favor of the king when she shows up unannounced and could have been killed right there at that moment. And then the king had to have insomnia in the middle of the night to wake up and go, I can't sleep, bring me that one book. And he gets this one book and he goes, oh, Mordecai did this thing and he was never rewarded. We should reward him in some way. If none of that happens, the insomnia doesn't happen, the Jews are dead. There's no such thing as a coincidence. The fact that the Jews were spared from destruction is evidence of God's protective work behind the scenes, orchestrating all of this. Karen Jobes, who is a scholar on this, says the book of Esther is the most true-to-life biblical example of God's providence precisely because God seems absent. Even in the most pagan corner of the world, God is ruling all things to the benefit of his people and the glory of his name. The great paradox of Esther is that God is omnipotently present even where God is most conspicuously absent. And that's true, by the way, in your life. God is omnipotently present even when it seems like he is conspicuously absent. Mike Cosper says it this way: for Christians, this story is a reminder that God doesn't abandon his people, no matter how dark their circumstances, how compromised their hearts are, or how hidden he may seem. Even in the darkest moments, when God seems absent, we can trust that he hasn't abandoned us. And then Karen Job, one more thing. She says, the major theological point of the book of Esther is that God fulfills his covenantal promises through his providence. The major point of contemporary significance is that God unfolds his will for individual lives through that same providence. The providence of Esther is the providence that's still at work today. I'll wrap up and prepare us for the Lord's table this morning by sharing with you a story that I shared back in October, a year ago, when we were preaching through Romans and we got to Romans 8:28. And I share this again because this is the story that reminds me of the working of God's providence. Whether we're talking about political intrigue or a Persian soap opera or a fairy tale, whether we're talking about the details of your life and the hard and confusing details that sometimes have you wondering, what is God up to? Or even, is there really a God in the first place? What we believe is what the Bible teaches, that God is working all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. This is a story that Larry Crabb tells about his own father and about his grandfather. Long before Larry was born, his dad, whose name was Lawrence, his dad was still a little boy when Larry's grandfather, Charlie, died. Charlie was 30 years old, and he became ill during the 1917 flu epidemic in Philadelphia. And Larry's dad, Lawrence, was too young to remember the details of his dad's death, but his mom, Laura, later told Lawrence about what happened. She said, "I was sitting beside the bed. Somehow I knew it was the end, and for the first time I cried in front of all of the kids. God was taking my Charlie after giving us such a short time together. He was leaving me a widow with four children. What was I to do?" The providence of God in that moment? God's at work for our good and his glory? Leaving a mother of four as a widow at age 30? Laura says, "Then Papa, Charlie, looked at me, and he recognized me, and I saw the tenderness again in his eyes, and I sat up, or he sat up and put his arms around me, and for a moment I thought he was going to get well. And then he said, 'Laura, Laura, don't cry, hush. God is in it.' And then he died." The book of Esther reminds us that in dark times, in hard times, when we wonder, is God in it? Can he be trusted? We've got to be still. We've got to hush and know he is in it. He's working these things for our good and for his glory. And maybe the greatest reminder of these things are found in the fact that God was in it when Jesus went to the cross. These elements that are here on this table point us back to the fact that God's providence is demonstrated for us in the death of his own son. The darkest hour in human history. We sang about it, the power of the cross. God's providence was on display there. In fact, two verses, I can't resist this, two verses that you, if you don't know these verses, you should, because these are evidence of God's providence from the mouths of the apostles. In Acts 2, the apostles, as they're praying, or as Peter's preaching about the death and resurrection of Christ, he says this: "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." Who was responsible for the death of Jesus, God or lawless men? Both. It was the definite plan of God carried out by lawless men. Are those men accountable for what they did? Absolutely. Were they free to make that choice? Absolutely. Was it the definite plan of God? Yes. How does that work? I don't know. But that's what the Bible says. Let me go to Acts chapter 4. This is the apostles praying together. And they say, "For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." Look, God is superintending all things. He is over all things. His providence is real, and it's pictured for us on this table. When we come and receive the bread and the cup, we are reminding ourselves that God, through his providence, made a way for us to experience salvation. If you're here this morning and you know Christ, you're welcome to come and participate in this family meal we'll have together. If you're here with us this morning as a visitor, or you're here and you're going, I don't know Christ, then rather than coming and taking bread and juice and being a part of this family meal, you ought to stop and consider the work and the providence of God. We'll have something up on the screen that you can read through and pray through as we go through this morning. But this is our opportunity this morning to come and to just reaffirm that God in his good providence is working all things, even the death of his son, for our good and for his glory. So you take a few minutes, prepare your hearts to come and receive these elements. We'll come down the outer aisles, take the elements back to your seat through the center aisle, and we'll take them together in just a minute. You prepare your hearts while I prepare the table.